Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky and I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. Before I introduce this morning's speaker, I want to thank everyone again for being flexible and patient with us as we transition TMR to a virtual platform. I would now like to introduce Dean Craig Boyce, the 12th Dean and Professor of Law at Syracuse University's College of Law, to introduce this morning's speaker. Dean Boyce.
Good morning, everyone. I am Craig Boyce. I'm the Dean of Syracuse University's College of Law. And I'd like to thank everyone who's virtually joined us this morning for what will no doubt be a very interesting, informative, and timely Thursday morning roundtable session. Today, we have as our special guest and speaker, Congressman John Katko. Congressman, welcome to Thursday morning roundtable. It's a pleasure for me to introduce him for several reasons. The first and most important one is that the Congressman is one of our distinguished alumni from the class of 1988. Every year, thousands of graduates of Syracuse University go out into the world and do great things, and we're particularly proud of those who give back to our community and the nation through public service. Congressman Katko is an exemplar of that. His career reflects what it is to be a committed public servant. Because I know the audience of Thursday Morning Roundtable has been growing since TMR started doing these sessions virtually, there may be some of our newer participants who are not as familiar with Congressman Katko. So for those folks, let me just provide a little bit of background. The Congressman was born in Syracuse. He's a graduate of Bishop Ludden High School, and he went on to Niagara University, where he earned a degree in political science in 1984. Congressman Katko then came to Syracuse University College of Law, where he earned his Juris Doctorate in 1988. Almost immediately after graduating law school, the Congressman entered public service. He worked for the Securities and Exchange Commission in Washington, D.C., and then transitioned to the Department of Justice, where he worked as an AUSA, Assistant U.S. Attorney, for 20 years. The Congressman served in numerous senior roles during his career with U.S. Department of Justice, with a strong focus on criminal prosecution of those involved in criminal enterprises related to violent gangs and narcotics trafficking. In 2014, the Congressman decided to step away from the U.S. Attorney's Office and dive into the political arena by running for Congress, and he did it successfully. Since 2015, the Congressman has represented the Syracuse and Central New York area that includes Onondaga, Cayuga, Wayne, and the southern half of Oswego County. Congressman just entered his fourth term as our representative in the U.S. House. Unless you're completely off the grid, you know that the current national political climate across the nation is heated, to say the least. But while the political climate is heated, the Congressman has continued his representation of NY24 in what is probably best characterized as middle of the road, listen to all voices, then make a judgment call on a vote or issue position as best he can. I know the Congressman has a lot to speak about this morning. We're in the middle of a global pandemic. There's a full-on national effort to get everyone vaccinated while simultaneously trying to get the economy firing on all cylinders again. In addition to all that, Congress has just begun the annual budget season. I want to highlight something extremely important and relevant not only to the country, but to the Congressman's committee work in the House, and that is the Russian cyber hacking of critical U.S. infrastructure and systems. For those who may not know, just a few weeks ago, the Congressman was appointed as a senior Republican member for the House's Committee on Homeland Security. That committee has jurisdiction over the Department of Homeland Security and a number of other agencies and departments. The Congressman's new role as a committee lead includes Congress's oversight and investigation of the Russian hack. I suspect the Congressman can't share much detail about the Russian hack and future threats because of security concerns, but I do think it will be helpful for the audience to hear about your new role, Congressman, within the context of the greater national security enterprise and why things like the Russian cyber attack can impact all of us. So please join me this morning in welcoming Congressman John Katko.
Thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in this morning. I appreciate the interest, and I'm always proud to represent I'm very proud of the school, and I remember teaching up to law school at times in the past and being a guest lecturer, and I'm very, very proud to be part of it today. So thanks for having me. I appreciate it, and national security is a big issue. I'm looking forward to engaging with all of you and answering any questions you have, but first I want to provide you all with a brief update on what I'm working on to help maybe stimulate some conversation. It's been a rough year, to say the least. As a nation, we've endured a bitter election fight, test to our democracy, and impeachment, all about combating a once in a 100-year pandemic. Like everyone in our community, I'm ready to move past this dark chapter, and I'm focusing on making progress in Congress, working across the aisle. Moving forward, I have my sights set on three main areas. First and foremost, the number one issue continues to be the pandemic. We urgently need people to get vaccinated and must remain vigilant in adhering to public health and safety guidance. To assess our community needs and offer my support in Congress, I've been constantly communicating with local leaders like County Executive Brian McMahon, who I'm very worried about with his double vision and everything, and Mayor Walsh, as well as local hospital administrators. From these conversations, it's clear the main challenge we still face is the shortage of vaccines. I just turned on the news this morning and they're talking about it again. And to accelerate our community's vaccine rollout, I spoke in person with Dr. Fauci, federal officials at Health and Human Services, FEMA, Department of Defense, and congressional leaders to implore them to address these supply issues in an equitable manner. I'm also working right now in Congress to deliver additional pandemic relief, including additional funding to accelerate vaccine distribution and to increase access to testing. Another area I'm working on and I'm vitally interested in is infrastructure. I've been interested in this since before I came to Congress. It's an area where I know we can find bipartisan agreement, and it's something I'll be prioritizing as a senior member of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Importantly for Central New York, my role on this committee will allow me to continue working on efforts that support the I-81 rebuild, keep our aviation system safe, and address our vast water infrastructure needs in Central New York that are quite serious. Lastly, I'm excited to share some exciting news of my own, and that is that I've been made the top Republican on the Homeland Security Committee. They call that position the ranking member. In this position, it will have far-reaching implications for Central New York. I'll be able to have impact legislative positions to make progress on some of our biggest priorities. Many of you probably have heard about the recent Solar Winds Act, and I know you just mentioned that, and it has received a lot of attention. And I'm happy to talk about that and some of the implications for that nationwide. But right here in Central New York, we were recently hit by a ransomware attack, which crippled the computer systems at a local high school and library and cost our local governments thousands of dollars. As ranking member, I'll be working on strengthening our cybersecurity across the board. Locally, we've also seen the tragic results of drug and human trafficking across the border. And during the pandemic, we've seen record high heroin overdose arrests. And we know that heroin that's killing the people is heroin that's laced with fentanyl, and the fentanyl's largely coming across the border, either from China or from the southern border. To stop the inflow of heroin and opioids and to combat human trafficking, I'll be focusing on strengthening our border security. And as ranking member, I'll also be tasked with conducting oversight over FEMA, which has a lot of impact on Central New York. It's the lead agency coordinating the COVID-19 response effort. And I've already started to work with FEMA leaders to address local concerns surrounding vaccine distribution and testing. Very concerned that the governor gets to say the winner, pick the winners getting the vaccine, when they're getting it, where they're getting them from, and working with FEMA to try and iron that out as well. FEMA is also a primary agency responsible for supporting communities that experience natural disasters, such as flooding along Lake Ontario. In the 117th Congress, I know there are a plethora of other issues facing our community: the opioid epidemic, improving access to mental health care, rebuilding 81, and so much more. This Congress, I think we have a great opportunity to make significant progress. There's a very small majority in the House with the Democrats. There's only a 5 or 6 member majority right now. And it's tailor-made for people like me who are working in the middle and work in a bipartisan manner. And I'm excited to do that. I'm excited to get to work. And I'm always grateful to get feedback from all of you. So I'm a big boy. If you have criticisms, let me have it. But I'm looking forward to the conversation, looking forward to the questions. And with that, I yield back. Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman. So now we're going to open it up for questions from the audience of the congressman. So I'll get us kicked off, get started. So can you talk about, Congressman, you've had a bipartisan role. You kind of pride yourself in that. So can you talk about what you've done in that and how you see that kind of moving forward?
Yeah, well, listen, bipartisanship is why I went to Congress. And think of what Ronald Reagan did with Tip O'Neill. Ronald Reagan, a hardcore conservative perceived as such, went to Congress and started working with Congress with Tip O'Neill, a hardcore liberal who had firm control of the House of Representatives. Together, they did tax reform, they did tax cuts, they did Social Security reform, and they did immigration reform. Could you imagine doing that in today's environment? We got to get back to that. We've got to get back to the time when the other side is not a pariah. The other side is not evil. I have a lot of friends on the Democratic side that I work with on a daily basis, and they want to work with me. And after some recent votes, they want to work with me even more. And we could talk about those as well. But the bottom line is, moving forward, if we don't work in a bipartisan manner, we're going to be in real trouble in this country. I think obviously America's had enough of the divisiveness, right? So I'm head of the moderate wing of the Republican Party. It's called the Republican Governance Group. It used to be called the Tuesday Group. Our ranks are swelling. We have probably 45 members that are going to be on board the next few weeks. I'm a senior member of the Problem Solvers Caucus. It's 28 Republicans, 28 Democrats. We meet every week, at least once a week, sometimes several times a week. And we work together to find bipartisan solutions. I have very good relationships with the head of the Blue Dogs, the Democratic Moderate Group. And, I'm perceived as somebody that they can come to work across the aisle. I have one of the best bipartisan ratings in Congress. And it's only because I don't just talk the talk, I walk the walk. And I don't even introduce a bill unless I have a Democrat as a primary co-sponsor. And I now, since I'm head of Homeland Security, I'm asking my colleagues on Homeland Security Committee, all 18 of the Republicans, to do the same. So we got a lead. We can't just talk about it. I'm happy to do that, and I'll continue to do that going forward.
Thank you so much. So the next question, I'm going to quote this person. The Republican Party failed to offer a platform at the most recent election. What do you think the party stands for?
Well, it can't be just about Ronald Reagan. It can't just be about Donald Trump. And I've obviously made that very clear. What we do stand for is lower taxes. There's a lot of things we were concerned about in the last election, and I was. The tax reform that we did really helped roll back, it rolled back taxes. And if you're a family of four making $50,000 or less, you're probably paying very little away of federal taxes anymore. And there's this myth that it's just a tax cut for the rich, but it's tax cuts across the board, and the highest percentage of tax cuts were for the lower income individuals. And what did that do? It exploded the economy. The economy had some of the best growth it's ever had, and lowest unemployment in the history of our country for African Americans, minorities, and women. And the last 2 years before the election, 74% of their jobs were in this country were filled by women. So a lot of good things happened with the conservative Republican principles, and we're concerned about what's already starting to happen with the Biden administration. And so we're going to 2022 will be a pretty interesting test of which way the country wants to go. I think despite all his foibles and all his personal shortcomings, there's a lot of good things that President Trump did, like the trade deals that he renegotiated, and taking a little tougher stance with people who are screwing us repeatedly, like China, and some of his foreign policy. So, we did have a platform. It's just, like the president, some of our ideas were shattered by the person.
All right, next question. As far as Homeland Security, what about white supremacy groups, and how are you going to combat the false lies on social media, such as QAnon?
Yeah, we just had a hearing last week on this very topic, domestic terrorism, and some of the things about what to do with social media and what to do with social media platform providers that are allowing this hate filled speech on both sides of the aisle, not just on the right, on the left, to flourish. It's a very difficult subject, but it's a conversation we have to have. Obviously, the results of January 6th have shown that the temperatures have boiled over on the right, and the left, we've seen that in over the summer and in continuing into this year, some on the left doing the same type of thing. So the bottom line is, across the board, we have to have this discussion about domestic terrorism. Do our laws that we have in place now, are they adequate for the task? I can tell you one thing right now is that the Homeland Security Committee as a whole, myself and Benny Thompson, the chairman, a Democrat, very good friend of mine from Mississippi, we're committed to doing as much as we can in this space, and we're not afraid to take it on. Lord knows I'm not, and I know he's not, and it's something we know we have to do going forward. It starts by having a discussion. It starts by recognizing the problem. And now we're in the midst of past that and analyzing whether or not the current laws we have and the current tools we have at our disposal are adequate.
Next question, again, I'm quoting, as our federal representative also serving on the Transportation Committee, the state has stated its preferred option for I-81. To the best of my knowledge, this person, you have been reluctant to state your preferred option. Isn't advocating for a choice essential to moving this forward? We are relying on you to move this forward. What steps are you taking to ensure we get local jobs and ensure housing stability for those living adjacent to 81?
Yeah, I've been working on all that. But if you think that my opinion is opinion that should carry the day on what we should have for 81, I think you're mistaken. My job is to make sure that the funding is there and that everyone's concerns are adequately aired and that whatever the community as a whole comes down on is what I will back 1,000%. What I've already done is deliver. I've delivered getting 81 through Central New York designated a high priority corridor. And I've also ensured 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, that we had a stabilized highway fund for the first time in over a decade that had 5 year funding. Now we're in the, doing a continuing resolution, excuse me, a 1 year reauthorization. We're hoping very much to start a new highway bill, discussions on that in the next few months. And we all recognize that one of the key shortcomings of the current highway bill are two things. One is the administrative labyrinth, which our locals must go through to try and get a project approved. And 81 is a shining example of that. But the other thing is to make sure that the funding is there. We have not fixed the gas tax formula since 1984 when Ronald Reagan was president. It was 18 cents a gallon. It was never indexed. It's now worth about 40 cents on the dollar. And we take $15 to $16 billion a year from the general funds of this country to try and plug the budget shortfalls in the highway fund. You couple that with the fact that the CAFE standards have caused miles per gallons to increase dramatically and to have electric cars and other alternative fuel vehicles. A lot less revenue is coming in, and we've got to recognize that. We've got to get creative, and we've got to do what's right and make sure the fund is properly funded going forward. And if you look at the pandemic, I think right now it's a perfect intersection of need being the highway, our infrastructures and our roads and bridges are in terrible shape, along with the pandemic's need for a stimulus package. And I think the two together could be really good. And I think we should really contemplate spending a substantial amount of our resources on getting a real true turbocharged highway fund for sure going forward.
Great, thank you so much. Next question. The system breach in the water treatment plant outside of Tampa is pretty scary. I haven't seen a lot of media coverage or heard a response from the federal government. As the ranking member of Homeland Security Committee, what are your thoughts on this? How do we protect our system so hackers cannot breach a system again?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll answer that in a second. I just want to add to my previous answer that I'm on a Transportation Infrastructure Committee, and I've specifically requested to stay on the Highway Subcommittee so I can deal with this issue firsthand. And with respect to the water hack, that's one of my greatest fears. People don't realize what a threat that cyber attacks are to this country and our lack of adequate cybersecurity poses to this country. And when I became ranking member, I've had several meetings with the chairman of Homeland Security. And quite frankly, cybersecurity has to be our top issue. It is the greatest threat to this country, far more than any other terrorist threat that we have, domestic or foreign. There's no question about it. And you look at the SolarWinds hack and what that represented, and we could talk more about that. That was such a sophisticated and intricate and devastating attack. But my greatest fear is what happened down in Florida happens writ large. Now, what happened in Florida was someone hacked into the water system and change the formula for chemicals that are added to the water and increase them exponentially, which if they weren't caught would have proved fatal to people. And we've got to recognize that. We've got to recognize the vulnerabilities in our systems, and we got to do so much more with respect to securing our infrastructure nationwide. I doubt that there's many water systems in this country or grids in this system or in this country or public works in this country that don't have malware embedded in them right now, that if the bad guys wanted to activate them to create mayhem here, that they would. I know we had our first major hearing on cybersecurity. And we had experts from across the country. I have a 5-point plan that I've introduced. We call it the five pillars. to help with cybersecurity, and I can get that to all of you. If you look at my website or do a Google search, you'll see the five pillars and what they are and what that means. We need to centralize our resources. We need to have a cyber czar in the White House, which I've advocated for, and I think President Biden is going to do that. And we've got a lot of work to do in this area, and you're going to be hearing a lot more about that going forward. I made it such a priority that my staff director was stolen from this Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency at Homeland Security, and he's running my shop for me. And we're peppered the 18 staff members with an awful lot of people with intricate cybersecurity experience. So it's a very big and very important part of what we're doing going forward as a country.
Great, thank you. Next question. With the reliance on 401k pension plans, the lack of reliable pensions offered by employers, how can we reinforce Social Security to make sure older Americans will have a secure, reliable retirement?
Yeah, I mean, it, right now, Social Security is solvent until 2032 or 2033. I don't pretend to have all the answers on this. I'm not on the budget committee for a reason. My wife will tell you I suck with budgets, but I will tell you that we all know we have time to make the adjustments to Social Security now. What those look like, I'm not sure, but I don't think we can do things that harm people that are in the pipeline already. I'm 58 years old. I went to government service at 28 and took a 60% pay cut. In part, looking at what Social Security would provide as a component of my retirement. People like that can't have their legs cut off from what Social Security changes that change and move the goalposts for them. But people coming into the system, if they have a whole life to plan for, that's a different story. So we got to have those tough conversations. What exactly they look like, I'm not sure, but I do think we should have them. And it's going to be very difficult in this such a politically charged environment, though, because people immediately demagogue that issue and use fear to scare people. But there's things we can do that I hope we can do to get it fixed. But we have time, but it sure would be nice if for once we acted ahead of time instead of at the very end like we usually do in Congress.
Thank you. Next question. President Biden has set a goal of admitting around 2,7500 new refugees and immigrants this year. 275,000. Will you be in the position of helping Syracuse as a sanctuary city bring in additional funds to ensure we provide our new Americans with the transitional services they will need?
Are you talking about refugees? Or are you talking about immigrants coming in that legally, or what are you talking about?
It looks like refugees, yes.
Oh, refugees. Yeah, listen, I've worked very closely with the refugee community here, and there's a big misnomer about refugees that people need to understand. They're not illegal aliens. They are fully vetted. They go through more of a vetting process than most people realize. And I think having increasing considerably the refugee population in Central New York is great. It's a very intricate fabric of what we have. You go to Stickley Furniture and see all the individuals at Stickley Furniture who are immigrants or refugees, and the craftsmen and the geniuses they are with making furniture and making them look beautiful, and all across our area. And I'm a very big supporter of Interfaith Works. I've helped people with refugee issues all the time. In fact, I was just over at Park Street two weekends ago in an apartment of someone who we just helped them get their wife over here. He was a refugee and she was caught in the bureaucratic nonsense. And we got her over here, and I was able to see them and be happy to welcome her into the United States. And I am a very big supporter of it. I am not a supporter of sanctuary cities. I don't think that local governments can pick and choose what laws they want to adhere to and what they don't. I think that's a very bad thing to get in the habit of doing. If you don't like laws, change them, but don't just ignore them because you choose to ignore them. So. I don't think there's an intersection between sanctuary cities and refugees. I think refugees come here the right way. They're fully vetted. Sometimes it takes years for them to go through the vetting process. But once they get here, I'm confident that they'll contribute to society and we'll do everything we can to help them. I've been a very big supporter of Catholic Charities. I've met with Mike Miller many times on this issue and the folks in Interfaith Works many times. And I think going forward that doing our part to help those that are refugees in this world is something from a moral standpoint we should be doing more of.
Great, thank you. Next question, again, I'm quoting on bipartisan issues. Number one, speaking as a Republican, they thank you for your January vote to impeach. Have you received
both? At least someone's thanking me.
Have you received any type of feedback on that? And two, for reapportionment, any comments about the process and the ultimate decision makers in New York State and whether there's a hope to keep all of Onondaga County plus district?
Let's just say my vote about impeachment, which I do not regret for one second. I think it's the toughest vote I'll ever take, but it's one of the proudest votes I ever took. And it's given me great clarity and great strength. But to say that caused an eruption of emotions across the spectrum would be a colossal understatement. It has been very difficult for myself and my family. The vitriol, the nastiness, what have you done for me lately? The ignoring all the good things I've done up until this point in some people's eyes. It's difficult to swallow, and it's a sad commentary on our current state of affairs. But I understand it, you know, and I don't diminish individuals who are mad at me about it. I appreciate those who said thank you. An awful lot of Democrats are calling and singing my praises, and I keep telling them, remember that a year from now. Or a year and a half from now when I'm up for re-election. But there's sometimes you got to take a vote, even if you know it might cost you your job. And this is absolutely one of them. I'm very proud of it. There's no doubt based on the facts. And I kept telling people it was 10 times worse than you could possibly imagine that day. I know officers who were beaten. I know an officer who was killed. Two officers committed suicide based on what the traumatic PTSD they suffered. 100 and some odd officers were hurt. Walking into that Capitol and seeing the mayhem that ensued afterwards, it really deeply affected me. But what more affected me is the president's conduct since the election. And people can't look at it in a vacuum. It started, in my opinion, his incitement started soon after the election when he refused to accept the results. And then as his legal challenges diminished, his rhetoric became more heated. And let's not forget, he's the one who invited everyone to come to Washington on January 6th. And he's the one who got people spooled up beforehand. He knew of the dangers of a problem beforehand because he was getting the same briefings we were. And yet he turned up the heat even that much more on January 6th. And then when he breached the Capitol, he refused to do anything about it. So I have no qualms about my vote. To think that he caught loose the president, vice president of the United States because the vice president simply said he was going to preside over the election certification is outrageous to me. And for people to walk into the Capitol chanting, hang Pence, and came within 60 seconds of getting him, can you imagine where our country would be if that happened? So I have no qualms about it. But for the process as a whole, the problems we have in this country is the gerrymandering on both sides of the aisle is ridiculous. And there was a bipartisan commission that the New York State Legislature formed. And it looks like Cuomo and some in the legislature are not going to fund that commission. And they're not going to give it the money and resources it needs to do its job. So Lord knows what's coming with that, right? Does the governor take, does he take umbrage to some people who are more critical of him than I am and harm them more? Is that a right way to do it? Or are we trying to do what's right for the American people and have a good cross section? My district's a good example. It's one of the worst districts for a Republican to hold in the country. I'm not griping about it, but that's just a fact. It's not right to do that writ large. I think the more balance you have, the better off we're going to have as a country. And we can't have a bunch of districts that are R24s dominated by Republicans, a bunch of districts dominated by Democrats. You do that, you're going to have the current political environment. And that's one of the big problems with gerrymandering on both sides of the aisle.
Great. Thanks so much. Next question. Is rational gun control legislation on your agenda after the January 6th riots? It would seem worthy of more serious attention again.
It's always a question. Now, listen, I don't make any apologies for being a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. And I would say if you want to change the Second Amendment and you want to do some of the things that are contemplated in legislation that's proposed, you have to have a constitutional amendment. And just like you have to have one with respect to, limitations on campaign contributions after Citizens United, I'm the first Republican, and I'm not sure if I'm the only one still that is an original co-sponsor of the a bill to overturn Citizens United via a constitution to have an amendment to the Constitution to limit campaign contributions. I think it's a critical necessity to do that. So I am mindful of gun issues. One of the big things I think is to get guns, not some guns, out of the hands of individuals who shouldn't have them. I think you get all guns out of the hands of individuals who shouldn't have them. And that's why I'm a very big proponent of red flag legislation. And I've authored it, and I'm working with my Democratic colleagues moving forward on that issue.
Great. Thanks so much. Next question. Opioid and heroin overdoses are becoming more and more prevalent during the pandemic. How do we attack this issue?
There's an intersection of mental health and heroin abuse. I think a lot of heroin overdoses are self-medication. I think this year is a good example. We know depression and suicide rates are very high this year. We also know that there's been a doubling of opioid fatalities in this county, I believe, at least through the first 6 months of last year there was, and or this year. And that's a real problem. It needs a multi-pronged approach. We have the CARA Act, the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act. We dedicated resources to it. It's nowhere near enough. We got to recognize the ubiquitousness of the problem, and you need a three-legged approach. You need to have enforcement, you need to have prevention, and you need to have treatment. And we don't have anywhere near the treatment that we should have for these individuals. And that's where we really fall down, I think. We do a lot with the border, and the intersection of border security and keeping drugs out of the veins and bodies of our children is really important. And people got to understand it's not just about stopping illegal aliens from coming across, so it's stopping the drugs from coming across or killing our kids. And, we need to make sure law enforcement has their tools, but prevention, I think, is where it's at. I really do. And I think that unless we really get prevention and treatment, those two things really turbocharged, we're going to continue to struggle. And any bill that comes up that provides more money for combating this issue, I'm all for.
Thank you. Here's a follow-up question related to your Transportation Committee position. Mm-hmm. For the last few years, there has been talk of Congress pushing a large infrastructure and transportation package forward. In previous large infrastructure bills, members have had the ability to propose specific projects for their districts and states so long as they meet program requirements set forth by the U.S. DOT, state DOT, and had support from the local elected officials, civic leaders, and the community. Do you think that member project proposals could occur again, given the discussion in Congress about congressionally directed spending items returning?
Yeah, there has been a lot of discussion about this, and I think this is a good point. Earmarks, what the old name was, and it's like Voldemort. It's like he must not be named. It's like the same thing with this. You're not supposed to mention the word earmarks anymore. They were outlawed in 2009, and what's happened? We have completely ceded the power of the purse to the executive branch. We put hundreds of billions of dollars a year in the hands of bureaucrats in the executive branch, and they decide the winners and losers on grant applications. I'm not saying we need earmarks coming back writ large, but for public works projects and things like that, where you as a congressman or a congresswoman know your district and know that there's targeted funding for specific projects, without having to go through a competitive bidding process where you may win and you may lose to something for reasons that are not fair. I think it's a good idea. You get fully and complete disclosure. I mean, we're not talking about building bridges to nowhere, which got us here, but let me give you a couple examples. Onondaga County needs to redo their entire sewer systems. The local sewer municipalities are a mess, right? And they're bankrupt and they're inadequate. And we're still not adhering to the strictures of our consent decree to keep water and sewage water flowing in Onondaga Lake. So we have to fix that system. And Onondaga County should be at the forefront of doing that. We should provide the money to help them with that. It's their money. And why should we have to try and go through these competitive grants where somebody out north who maybe has, maybe the kid at the bureaucracy that's making the decision that grant is from that area gets them that money instead. We should have very targeted things that are very important. And I can't think of a better example than Interstate 81 was another one. I mean, that's something obviously we all needs to be taken care of and fixed. And so whatever the iteration is, we gotta make sure there's proper funding for it. So I think very limited and very targeted and fully disclosable in the infrastructure realm is probably something that I could support.
Thank you. Next question. Sure. Where do you stand on climate change and efforts to control carbon emissions?
Yeah, there's no question that I agree that man contributes to it. I'm one of a handful of Republicans who routinely sign resolutions acknowledging such. I think that what I have been doing is supporting a tremendous amount of money that should be transferred from fossil fuel research to renewable research. I'm a big believer in nuclear power as a bridge to that point in time where we can get to fully renewable resources. I don't believe in the Paris Accords, and I'll tell you why. It allows China to build as many coal burning power plants as they want until 2030. And then we're going to tell China, you got to be in compliance. There's not a single signatory to the Paris Accords that's in compliance, to my knowledge. And at the same time, United States has reduced carbon emissions by a substantially larger margin than any of the signatories to the Paris Accords. We can do it. And whatever we do to reduce emissions, if it's fair and completely even playing field internationally and fully enforceable, I would be for it. And I do think that anything we can do to help reduce carbon footprints, both nationally and internationally, in a fair and even manner, we should. But just think about what's going to happen to China in 2030 when all of a sudden they got to start coming into compliance with the Paris Accords. And they have all these big, beautiful coal-burning plants and everything else that they have. What do you think China's going to do? China's going to tell us to go stuff it. And they're going to tell us to go pound sand. And then where are we at then? Right? So I think fully enforceable. There's been some proposals that are intriguing. And we got to keep working on those types of proposals that make it a very level playing field going forward.
Thank you. I'm just going through the chat for the questions. There's a lot of thank yous in there for your vote to impeach. I just wanted to pass those along.
Let's hear some of those.
next question. January 6th was a very traumatic day. How are you personally doing, and have you been able to get vaccinated?
January 6th was a watershed moment for a lot of people. I've been very worried about my staff, even though they weren't there that day. There's been a lot of indications a lot of these kids were traumatized by what they saw. And the only thing I can tell them and I tell you is whatever you saw, it was 10 times worse, 100 times worse. Like I alluded to earlier, seeing the Capitol in such disarray and walking across shards of glass to go and vote to certify an election that should always be done in a very peaceful and respectful manner was just stunning to me. Talking to people like the officers, like after the attack, about 1 a.m, first of all, I would like everybody else, we were in our offices, we were told to barricade our doors. Some of the bad guys got into our building and we were told to turn off the lights. And, you know, and you're sitting there thinking, okay, I hear footsteps down the hall. What's going to happen? You know, you think it could be it. But I was sitting there at my desk, just wondering, you know, what's going to happen. And and I've been through a lot of threats as a prosecutor, so it's kind of routine for me, unfortunately. But for a lot of people, it wasn't. And a lot of people are very traumatized by it. And let's not forget that the woman who was trying to get into the floor of the House with others to get after the members of Congress was shot just outside the door where we voted several hours later. And there's a lot of indication of that shooting when we went back to the house, broken doors, broken windows. There is a lot of trauma, but then you sit there and the Capitol Police, I really break my heart. About 1 a.m, they finally opened up the cafeteria to give us something to eat when things were secured. And I went down and I was talking to these guys and they had blood on their hands from fighting these people. They had bruises, their clothes were torn. A lot of them were beat up pretty severely. Some have very serious injuries, and I really worry about them more than anything. And my fears were realized when 2 of them committed suicide since then. And now it's coming out how incompetent the Capitol Hill Police and the Sergeant at Arms were, knowing the risks and knowing the problems that could result in what they didn't do, is compounding the concerns for those folks. And so people in law enforcement, I'm most concerned about. I'm concerned about a lot of my colleagues. A lot of them aren't used to dealing with some of the stuff I've had to deal with in my life as far as threats. But we'll get past it. But if we don't learn from the shame on us, and everybody should pay attention to what's going on in the Senate right now, wherever you are on the political spectrum, just to make sure that you see it, understand the depth and the gravity of how bad it was and how close we came to having our vice president killed and members of Senate and Congress killed. Think where we would be then. And we should never, ever let this happen again. And let's not forget, it's the first time our Capitol has been invaded since the War of 1812. And it's not a small thing. It's a gigantic thing. And it's something that we should be very mindful of going forward.
Well, we're all glad you're okay. All right.
Me next, too.
next question about internet. Access to affordable internet services and devices and knowledge about their use is fundamental to every American, especially now, obviously, for health, getting to work, education, staying socially connected. How can or are you supporting our region in eliminating our digital divide?
Yeah, 5G technology is of paramount importance. We have to get 5G technology, and it has to be everywhere. In the CARES Act, we had some funding for 5G technology and rural broadband and connectivity. But you got to step back and understand the gravity of the problem. It's probably a third of our country is not connected to the internet because of a lack of proper infrastructure. That's got to change. How the hell can a farmer that's trying to hang on in an international market compete on that market when he doesn't have access to the internet? How does that happen, right? And how do kids in this modern day and age of Zooms and remote teaching and telehealth and everything else we have going on, mental health counseling, all those things were kind of have come of age during the pandemic. And we have to understand that we have to have connectivity. So as part of our infrastructure package, there's a lot of discussion about going the final mile to make sure that we have connectivity for everybody. I'll give you an example. My in-laws have a farm out in the middle of nowhere. It's a beautiful place, but it's in the middle of nowhere. They have now on the telephone lines going up the road, they have the cables in for connectivity, rural broadband. But it's going to be 2 to 3 years at a minimum, maybe longer, before they go that final 100 yards or whatever to connect everybody up. And that doesn't make any sense to me. It's like, if we have a lot of the infrastructure, New York State's done a pretty good job incentivizing people to connect up. But we've got it. I think the bottom line is we got to treat it like we did in the 1930s with a rural electrification project and just say every farm in every rural area needs to have electricity. And now I think every farm in every rural area and every city area and every urban area that doesn't have it needs to have connectivity. And that's, I think 5G is the best way to do it. And that's what we really got to push. Now, to circle back to cybersecurity, you damn well better make sure that 5G technology is secure. And there's a lot of concerns about the companies like Huawei that has spyware embedded within their 5G technology. So making sure we have very good supply chain technologies. And to circle back again, this is kind of interesting. Coin Industrial Laundries in Syracuse, because of the tax reforms, is now being rebuilt into a 5G manufacturing center. And it's going to have all American components and much more secure network parts. And so that's why tax reform was good. That's why 5G technology is good. That's why being keenly aware of cybersecurity is good. So
next question actually also relates to that. What can be done to make our supply chain less dependent on China?
Listen, think about this, not just in the cyber realm, but across the board. Not too long ago, Bristol-Myers Squibb in DeWitt produced 60 to 70% of our nation's penicillin supplies, now produces zero. And none of it is produced in the United States. And the vast majority of it is produced either in whole or in component parts out of China. What do you think China is going to do if we really get into a snot knocker with them? You know, that we have to bring back some of that technology to the United States. And we have to incentivize technologies to come back to the United States. Not because it's like take care of our own and screw the rest of the world. I think it's we've got to face the reality that we have to be more secure. Personal protective equipment at the beginning of this pandemic, there's mad shortages. And if it wasn't for the FEMA's initiation of the air bridge, getting a bunch of personal protective equipment from elsewhere, we wouldn't have had any personal protective equipment to speak of. So we've got to look at critical things that we need, stockpiles and medicines, and realize we need to incentivize them to come back here. And I don't necessarily blame companies who are going overseas because things are cheaper, But we've done a lot in the last few years to level the playing field from a tax standpoint, which is very, very important, and in a trade standpoint. And I think if we roll those back, it's going to make us that much more vulnerable. We need to incentivize people to come back home for sure.
Thank you. Can we and should we address our national debt?
Yes. And should we? Yes. Can we? It's going to take, people's going to have a stomach to do it. Yeah, I think we have to. At some point, every dollar we spend is a dollar that our children's and our children's children are going to have to deal with. It's just that bad a problem. And I know there's this American habit of just spend now and worry about it later. But at some point, we need to worry about it. And, you know, just throwing money around without paying for it. And that's why I like with the highway bill. The highway bill should be self-sustaining. The highway fund should be self-sustaining. It's a user fee. That's what a gasoline tax is. It's really a user fee. If you use it, you pay for it. We just need to be much more fiscally responsible. We need to do the things we need to do to make sure that happens. And there's very difficult decisions. And again, you go back to how much people will demagogue the heck out of issues like this. You got to stop. You know, if someone told me tomorrow, if you did X, Y, and Z, it would balance the budget, but it would cost you your job. Sign me up. I would do it in a heartbeat. And I feel the same way about fixing Social Security, some of the other things. There's some things you got to be willing to sacrifice for. And fixing the debt issue is something I'd be all happy for. Again, I suck with numbers, so I don't pretend to know the answers, but I do know that we need to do it. We can't tax your way out of it. You got to grow the economy, but you can make some changes that would make it work, I think.
Thank you. Where do you stand on future support for a stimulus bill?
See, after we talk about spending, well, here you go. I think something that is going to be, I've supported them all. I understand it. There's not an economist that would tell you that we shouldn't have done what we've done already. If we didn't do it, the debt would be much worse and our economy would take that much longer to recover. So I think what we had to do is necessary. I think going forward, we got to make sure of that. The president's talking about $1.9 trillion package. Okay. I'm supporting a lot of components of it, but let's not forget that there's billions upon billions upon billions of dollars that aren't even spent yet from the previous packages. So let's make sure we're not just, we're spending like drunken sailors, like we tend to do as Americans, and make sure it's as targeted as can be. And I do think that one of the best stimulus bills and probably one of the most productive for the economy would be a new highway bill and a new infrastructure package. Because to me, like I said earlier, it's like the intersection of need and a pandemic. And for every dollar you spend on an infrastructure package, you usually it goes about $5 to $6 to the good in the economy, local economies where you're spending that money. So it's a win-win. And to me, that's smarter than just, you know, the throwing money at things writ large.
All right. So we're going to stay on the money questions. Next question. While the upper percentile of Americans have done very well the past 4 years, we continue to leave the middle class and poor people behind. What about a minimum $15 an hour wage? What is your stance on that?
I'm all for paying people as much as we can, but it's absolutely clear that if you did that, you would be hurting the very people that you're trying to help. That being individuals in lower income brackets, because it would lead to at least a million person job loss. Would some be better off? Of course, right? But if it's going to lead to job losses, how is that the way to go? To me, the better thing to do is to lower the taxes as best we can. For individuals and make sure that the economy is booming and that there's plenty of opportunity for them, right? And the second thing is, I think we've kind of latched on to this thing that the minimum wage is a living wage. And when we're looking at the minimum wage in this country as a living wage, we've got real structural problems that we should look at instead of just saying, well, raise the minimum wage because that's going to be the living wage. But if that's a living wage, that's not good. Minimum wage when I was a kid was $2 an hour. Literally, I worked at the state fair. I think it was $2.65 an hour. I worked 81 hours. My paycheck was $162. I almost fell over when I got it, how little it was when I was in high school. But it's not meant to, it was never meant to be anything other than to step you up and get you into the workforce. And now it's being viewed as something different. And I really think that we need to look at the structural inefficiencies and problems in our economy. With all that being said, if you told me a $15 minimum wage wouldn't lose any jobs, I'd be all for it. But if it's going to lose jobs, I think you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. So let's keep talking about what's the best way to get people into the workforce, job training. There's a million person job shortage in the cybersecurity field alone. Training kids in the high school and grammar school levels on cybersecurity and cyber issues, making them proficient, then go out and make a crap load of money while even going to college. So to me, let's not cut off our nose to spite our face. That's all I can say. Hope that makes sense.
Thank you. And we have time for just one more question. Companies like Amazon have not paid taxes. Are you satisfied with that, or would you make changes in our tax structure?
No, listen, if that's the case, I'd be happy to take, I'm all for looking at that, you know, and like I said earlier, though, the greatest percentage of tax cuts were the low-income individuals when we did the tax reform. But if people are still gaming the system and there's ways to close the loopholes, for sure. You know, I'm all for that. And I'm happy to take a look at that. I fought very hard to get some sort of SALT deduction in the tax package before. There wasn't going to be any. I think we need more of a SALT deduction. I think there's this prevailing wisdom that blue states are fiscally irresponsible, whatever. To me, it's a sense of fairness. You know, so to do those types of things to help people in lower income brackets, for sure. And if we can do things to close the gaps with the uber wealthy, I'm happy to take a look at it.
Great. Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we are out of time. So please join me in virtually thanking Congressman Katko for speaking to us this morning. Thank you.
I appreciate it. I'm proud of my alma mater. I'm hoping Syracuse basketball gets a few wins and the football turns a corner too. So God bless everybody. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.